Good morning, and welcome to Thursday Morning Roundtable. My name is Kate Flannery, and I'm the Executive Director of Community Engagement at Syracuse University. I will be your moderator for today. Before we begin, I would like to acknowledge with respect the Onondaga Nation, fire keepers of the Haudenosaunee, the indigenous people on whose ancestral lands Syracuse University now stands. Thursday Morning Roundtable is a weekly public forum hosted by Syracuse University's Office of Community Engagement that features prominent newsmakers who discuss current events in Central New York and beyond. I have the distinct pleasure to introduce our guest speaker today, Brian Taylor, Professor of Political Science in the Maxwell School of Citizenship and Public Affairs. Professor Taylor is the author of three books on Russian politics, most recently, The Code of Putinism, Oxford University Press, 2018. He received his BA from the University of Iowa and an MS from London School of Economics and Political Science, and his PhD from MIT. It is with great pleasure that I introduce and share the screen with Professor Brian Taylor.
Thank you very much, Kate. Very happy to be here. So I'm going to talk for, I think, about 25, 30 minutes about Russia's war against Ukraine. I'll talk about four different aspects of it. So first of all, just addressing the issue of why this war came about at this time. Second, I want to talk a bit about the course of the war so far. We're 7 weeks in at this point. Third, I want to talk about what it might mean for Russian internal politics. And then fourth, I want to talk about the U.S. role in this war so far. So first of all, why are we at war now? We're at war now because Vladimir Putin made a decision to go to war. This is very much his war. He made it largely by himself, surrounded with a very small group of advisors. So what precipitated him to take this step right now? For those of us who've been watching him for a while, there were different opinions about how likely it was that he would go to war. But I think if we look back over his entire career, we can see multiple things that led us up to this moment. So from very early on in his presidency, he has made clear two things. One is that he believes that Russia is not given its due place in the world and that it was threatened and is threatened by external actors, especially the United States and the West in general. And second, that he did not see the collapse of the Soviet Union as completely legitimate. And in particular, he did not think that Ukraine was a separate nation that deserved to rule its own state in the way it saw fit. So let me just say a few things about those two things. So as early on as 2004, so just a reminder that Vladimir Putin first became president of Russia on the eve of the millennium at the very beginning of the year 2000. So in 2004, they suffered a very serious terrorist attack in a place called Beslan in southern Russia. Some of you may remember it. Over 300 people died, including over 150 school children. And this attack was the act of Chechen terrorists from this breakaway region in southern Russia, where they've been fighting since the mid-1990s. And when he went on TV afterwards to address the public about the reasons for this event, he strangely did not mention Chechnya at all, but he said that people were trying to tear a juicy piece off of Russia, and others were helping them because they wanted to weaken a nuclear power. And so he didn't say it directly, but he implied there, and then he later confirmed that he was thinking about the United States. He implied that the United States was supporting Islamic terrorists engaging in terrorist attacks in Russia with the goal of weakening Russia and tearing off some of its territory. So this notion that Russia is in some sense at war with the West and the United States is trying to undermine Russia goes back very deep. In 2006, he compared the United States' role in the world to Nazi Germany. And he has complained repeatedly over several decades over the dominant U.S. role in the world, how Russia is not given the proper respect, how U.S. foreign policy works against Russian interests. And this is not only in terms of things that many of you have probably heard some discussion about, such as the decision to expand NATO membership after the collapse of the Soviet Union and the end of the Cold War, but also in terms of the domestic politics of Russia's neighbors. So whenever there was some kind of popular uprising or change of government that was unexpected in a neighboring country like Ukraine, like the country of Georgia, which is to the south of Russia, and other countries in the region, he always blamed the United States and said that the CIA or other actors were trying to foment revolution around Russia's borders. And Putin and some of his close associates often implied that the ultimate goal of all these uprisings in areas around Russia was to weaken Russia and ultimately force it to disintegrate. So I guess I should say, to be quite explicit, that this is not in fact true. The United States has not been and was not fomenting revolutions around Russia's borders in order to try and weaken and dismantle Russia. But this has been a constant talking point of Putin and the people around him. And I think many people assumed that this was just propaganda for his own domestic consumption. But I think it's more accurate to see this as a reflection of his pretty deep-seated views about Russia is a great power, about the U.S. as an enemy, about the vulnerability of Russia after the collapse of the Soviet Union, and his feelings of resentment and humiliation about how he believes Russia has been consistently mistreated. Now, I will say, from the point of view of a Russian leader, some of the things that he has talked about, such as the U.S. war against Iraq in 2003, U.S. decision to withdraw from some arms control treaties, U.S. decisions to expand NATO, all of those things from the point of view of a Russian leader might be concerning. But where he went beyond that was extrapolating out from this or that foreign policy decision to this idea that there was this big American conspiracy to weaken and attack Russia. So that's one piece of his worldview that I think very much informs the situation we're in now. The second piece that I mentioned was his belief about Ukraine not being a real state, as he sometimes put it. So very early on in his presidency in the early 2000s, he said to one of his associates that if we don't do something about Ukraine, we're going to, quote unquote, lose it, as if Ukraine was something that Russia had to lose. And in 2008, at a meeting with U.S. President George W. Bush, he said to him, "George, you understand Ukraine's not even a real state. Half of, or you know, part of it was given to them by Poland, and the bigger part was given to them by us." So he's long expressed grievances about the formation of Ukraine as an independent state, his notion that it was artificially created in the early period of the Soviet Union. He specifically blames the Soviet ruler at the time, a guy you may remember named Vladimir Lenin. And he has harbored these grievances in about Ukrainian independence for a while. And one thing that this connects to is that both in 2004 and in 2013, 2014, there were popular uprisings in Ukraine that led to a change of government, and a more pro-Western government took power both of those times. In both of those cases, Putin did not think this was a natural reflection of the will of the Ukrainian people. He thought it was something that had been inspired by the outside. So in 2014, he specifically blamed what was called the Euromaidan Revolution on the CIA. He said they were experimenting like on rats, not understanding what they were doing. And this led him, as you probably recall, to annex the Crimean Peninsula from Ukraine using military force in 2014, and to sponsor an insurgency war with the use of Russian assistance in the southeast part of Ukraine, an area known as the Donbas, starting in 2014. So in some sense, Russia's been explicitly at war with Ukraine for the last 8 years, not just over the last 7 weeks. Now, one question I think that might occur to people is, why is it that Putin has this much power in this system? Political scientists refer to the type of autocracy that Russia has as a personalist autocracy. So we can think of different types of authoritarian regimes. There are monarchies, there are military juntas, there are single party regimes like the Soviet Union used to be, and China to some extent still is. But then there are the personalist types, where much depends on the personality of the leader, and this leader weakens all other institutions and restraints on their rules. So Putin has, over a period of 22 years, built a very centralized personalist autocracy in which he has the final decision on most important matters. How does that lead into this war? It leads into the war in the way that he narrowed his circle of advisors over the years. He increasingly met with only a small group of people, and they had to be loyal to him. And they understood that it was in their interest to give him a picture of the world that was consistent with his picture. So I think it's reasonable to conclude that military and intelligence agencies that were meeting with Putin in the run-up to this war oftentimes told him what he wanted to hear, convinced him that this would be an easy lift for Russia and that the war would be over in a matter of weeks, and did not really understand internal Ukrainian dynamics, and they did not understand how fiercely the Ukrainian state and the Ukrainian military and the Ukrainian people would fight. And this is a common problem that political scientists have observed in regimes of this type, where they often mistakenly blunder into wars that they think are going to be easy, but turn out to be quite disastrous for the regime. So we got a lot of signals starting really last spring, a year ago, that Putin was planning something in Ukraine. And with respect to Ukraine, he built up his forces on the border even then in April 2021. In the summer of 2021, he wrote a very long article, which sitting presidents rarely do, right? It was as long as an article in the Scientific Journal, making his argument that if you look back at Ukrainian and Russian history, Ukrainians and Russians are one people. They have historically always been united, and the separation of them is somehow an unnatural event. So in his mind, Ukrainians don't freely choose to be closer to the EU in the West than Russia. This is something that outsiders have inspired and something that really goes against the legitimate will, in his view, of the Ukrainian people. So I think this is one reason that he thought that the war would go easy, was because he expected Ukrainians to welcome Russian intervention. Now, one of the things that happened after the annexation of Crimea and the starting of the war in the Donbas was that the U.S. and its allies put sanctions against Russia and also started to help the Ukrainian military reorganize itself, become more effective, and eventually start supplying it with certain types of weapons. So even though it was pretty clear that Ukraine had no realistic possibility of joining the North American Treaty Organization, NATO, at any point, because many countries believed Ukraine was not ready and that bringing Ukraine in would be seen as a provocation by Russia and not wanting to get in that situation, despite the pretty clear messaging that there was no imminent prospect of Ukraine joining NATO, Putin became more and more worried about what he saw as NATO and Ukraine. So NATO member countries training Ukraine, providing them with arms, and those sorts of things. So from his perspective, this assistance to Ukraine eventually was going to lead into a direct threat to Russian territory. And he wanted to try and stop that evolution in Ukrainian foreign policy. Now, the problem is Ukraine took this path precisely because of Putin's own action. So his annexation of Crimea in 2014 took the most pro-Russian voters in Ukraine, in the largest Russian-speaking region in Ukraine, and made it part of Russia, which meant that the rest of Ukraine was naturally more pro-Western because the pro-Russian voters were taken out, at least a section of them, and made part of Russia. And then those who remained in Ukraine were angry at this annexation of part of their territory, so became also more pro-Western. So this problem is a problem that he himself created. But rather than admitting that he had created this problem, he saw it as something that had been done to Russia and that was a direct threat to Russia. So I think that's enough background on why Putin decided to go to war at this point. Let me say some things about the progress of the war itself. So it seems pretty evident that the initial plan on the Russian side was to quickly launch an assault on Kyiv, the capital of Ukraine, from the north, and this is from the territory of the country of Belarus, which is an independent country technically, but is closely aligned with Russia and became extremely closely aligned with Russia after August of 2020, when the dictator in Belarus, a man named Alexander Lukashenko, held on to power in a fraudulent election and faced massive protests on the streets of Belarus. He had to call on Russia for financial and media and even to a certain extent military assistance at that point. And so he was in no position really to refuse Putin's request to deploy Russian troops in Belarus. And that was the closest attack route to Kiev. And so the idea was they would send in some paratroopers to capture an airport outside Kiev, run a large formation down the highway directly from Belarus to Kiev, seize the capital, overthrow the government, and put in place a loyal puppet government to Russia. As we all know, that plan collapsed because the Ukrainian state was not weak. It was not on the verge of collapse. It was not, as he saw it, a group of what he called neo-Nazi usurpers who had seized power in Ukraine. In fact, Ukraine has a democratically elected government headed, as you know, by President Zelensky, who himself is part Jewish and had relatives die in the Holocaust. So this notion that Ukraine had this sort of extreme right-wing neo-Nazi government was absurd, but it's consistent with his view that any government in Ukraine that wants to align with the West and doesn't want to be closer to Russia is in some sense an unnatural historical development. So Ukrainian resistance was extremely effective, and they managed to keep Russia from seizing the capital and really from seizing any of the largest cities in the south and east. They seized one in the south near Crimea called Kherson, and they've reduced to rubble a city called Mariupol that you've probably heard about in the news, a city of 500,000 people. On the Sea of Azov, so that's in the southeast part of Ukraine. But even then, there are still Ukrainian forces fighting to try and keep Mariupol out of Russian hands because it's an important port city. Now, after about a month, it became clear that they were not going to be able to seize Kiev, and they pulled out the troops that had come in from the north and northeast and are repositioning them currently to the eastern part of Ukraine, the Donbas area and areas adjacent to that. And all indications are that they're planning another larger offensive against that part of Ukraine. And that seems to be starting to unfold now. There are images already of large tank columns pouring into that part of Ukraine that already were under Russian control. And I think we can expect an advance in that direction soon. And the plan seems to be to try and encircle part of the Ukrainian armed forces that are located in that eastern part of Ukraine, where they've been fighting with Russia, as I mentioned earlier, already for 8 years. So that is the next major step that we can expect to see in the war over the next month. I would say that I doubt if Russia will succeed in enveloping or encircling this portion of the Ukrainian armed forces. It's quite a distance they would have to travel from two different directions. And the forces that they will be putting into the war are in some sense being cobbled together from existing units that had already taken heavy losses in other parts of the war. So I should mention at this point that as far as we can tell, Russia has lost probably 10 to 15,000 troops to deaths alone. And that implies probably another, let's say, 25 to 40,000 troops being injured or being unable to go into battle. They've lost literally hundreds of tanks, and so they're having to reassemble units, but their units don't have appropriate amounts of personnel to be able to properly protect tank assaults, which is why the Ukrainians have been very effective at using anti-tank weapons to hit lead vehicles in convoys and then force the Russians into stopping. Now, one thing that has been pretty surprising to experts on Russian military affairs is that Russia has seemingly been unable to effectively use all of the parts of its military together in its war. So it was assumed that very early on in the war, Russia would be able to use superior air power to take the Ukrainian Air Force out of commission, to knock out the major runways and use its, dominance, it was thought to be an air power, to keep the Ukrainians mainly fighting on the ground. But that has not been the place. Russia has not been the case. Russia has not been able to keep Ukraine from flying planes and drones. And they seem to be unable to link up in real time air power, tanks and artillery to combine to launch overwhelming assaults on Ukrainian military forces. So instead, they've been using pretty indiscriminate missile and air power bombing of major Ukrainian settlements such as Kharkiv and Mariupol. So we're seeing a very brutal kind of war in which they attack civilian populations. You probably all have seen the stories about war crimes being committed by Russian troops in various places and bombings of civilian installations. Unfortunately, I expect that to continue because the Russian military, when it can't do things the smart way, is willing to do things the more brutal way. All right. So what does this mean for Russian politics internally? Just from the point of view of someone who's been to Russia many, many times now for over 30 years, 35 years. It's very sad. Obviously not sad in the way it's sad for Ukraine, where tens of thousands of people, around 10,000 people have been killed. Millions have fled their homes. Millions more are living without shelter, et cetera. So obviously this is, first of all, a tragedy for Ukrainians, but it's a disaster for Russia as a country as well, for those of us who hoped Russia might be on a more positive trajectory after the collapse of the Soviet Union. Those hopes, I think, unfortunately, have been left in ruins, and they have a very strong authoritarian government that also has imperial ambitions in the region and are carrying out those imperial ambitions. The sanctions that have been put on Russia by not only the United States, but by the European Union, by the United Kingdom, by Japan, by South Korea, by Singapore, by Taiwan, by Australia, many other countries, are going to, over time, have a crippling effect on the Russian economy. Now, they can't stop the war, right? Sanctions take longer to work than it takes planes to fly or tanks to drive. But over the medium to long term, I think we're going to see economic depression in Russia. We're going to see higher unemployment. We're already seeing signs of pretty high inflation. And we're going to see degradation of various parts of the Russian economy that have depended upon imports from more advanced economies in the West. And this will affect their ability not only to produce military power going forward, but to produce and export energy and to produce other things for the Russian domestic market, whether it's cars or things like that. And they're going to be restricted in their access to things like computer chips that they need for other parts of their economy. So this is a disaster for the Russian economy and for average Russians. Now, what does this mean in terms of the stability of the regime? I think we can say that prior to the war, Putin faced zero threat to his hold on power, or close to zero threat. Autocrats like Putin face threats from two basic sources. One is from other members of the elite. So what we might loosely call a coup, but I don't just mean the military, any attempt to remove him by a group of insiders. The other threat they face besides from elites is from the masses in terms of possible protests. We have seen, some significant protests, especially in the first couple of weeks, more than 15,000 detentions in the first 2 weeks in other cities around the country. But the amount of coercive power that's been directed at protesters in terms of arrests and detentions has been extreme. They passed a law which could put someone in jail for up to 15 years for what they call, disrespect for the armed forces or promoting false information about what Russia calls the special military operation. So large-scale protests have largely died out. I don't think there's any threat of popular uprising at any point in the foreseeable future. In terms of a possible threat from other members of the elite, we also really don't see any sign of that being a danger at this point. So as I mentioned earlier, in a personalist autocracy, a lot depends on the leader at the top. He surrounds himself with loyalists. And so the group of people who are in charge of the armed forces, who are in charge of the internal security forces, the internal security police, and the Kremlin Guard are all very loyal to him. They don't necessarily trust each other. And it's hard to imagine them being able to coordinate any kind of effort to remove Putin. One final thing I'll say about the elites is in the early weeks, especially in the first week, it seemed clear that a lot of members of the elite were surprised by the war and secretly opposed the war. They did not see it coming. They thought it was going to be a disaster for Russia economically and politically, which it is. But it does seem that that kind of opposition in the elite isn't as present anymore, that they've rallied around Putin, that the strong sanctions put on Russia have led them to decide that they agree with his view that, that Russia itself is under threat from the West, and so they're sticking with him. So the short version is I think Putin is in power for a while, at least. I would say that the risk to him has gone up, but it's still not to the point that we would expect any kind of fall from power anytime soon, which I think means the war is likely to continue because I don't see him backing down other than in a situation in which the Ukrainians simply defeat the Russian military being sent into the war, re-seize Ukrainian territory and expel the Russian military, which I don't think the Ukrainians are capable of doing. Now, they've been underestimated by many, including by me so far, but I think that would be too heavy a lift for the Ukrainian military, which means, unfortunately, I think the war is going to go on for months and perhaps longer. All right, one final thing before taking questions. I want to talk about the United States. I would give the high marks to the Biden administration for its response to the war in two very important respects. First of all, you probably remember in the months leading up to the war that everyone was talking about the possibility that Russia would attack Ukraine. The reason everyone was talking about this was because the Biden administration selectively released intelligence that it had that this war was coming. And they were able to use this intelligence to warn not only the Ukrainian government, but the world and our allies that this was a possibility. In doing so, they undercut the ability of Russia to sell some kind of story about how the war was forced on Russia by some kind of Ukrainian attack or something like that. They tried to do a little bit of that early on, but it really was not selling. Because everyone had seen the intelligence, seen the military buildup, knew Russia was putting in place the forces to launch an assault, and heard President Biden and others speaking quite openly that we expect Russia to attack Ukraine in the coming weeks and months. So I think that was very effective. And the second part that I want to give them a lot of credit for, which is organizing a global coalition to impose some of the harshest sanctions ever put on a country of Russia's size, really in history. I mean, the way they blocked hundreds of billions of dollars of Russian central bank assets in the West, the sanctions they put on banks, the sanctions they put on individuals have been very far reaching and have had a real effect on the Russian economy and could, according to economists that I think know a lot about Russian economics, think may push Russia into defaulting on its foreign debt in coming weeks, which it hasn't done really since early after the Soviet Union was created. So this is an unprecedented set of sanctions. It's going to cause Russian economy to drop by about 10% this year, people think, and could cause real economic pain going forward. Now, the final thing I would say, and this is perhaps even to the surprise of the United States and its allies, is the extent to which very quickly, people in the West who work for the government have been willing to send Ukraine more and more military equipment, not only defensive weapons like anti-tank weapons and anti-air defense systems, which have been extremely important and necessary, but also offensive weapons as well. And we're seeing talk now about sending armored personnel carrier tanks, helicopters, and even fighter jets. So even though the United States has made extremely clear that it will not directly enter the war, will not send troops into the war, that we have no allied commitment to send our military into Ukraine, that it will continue to supply Ukraine with weapons. Other countries in Europe have been supplying Ukraine with weapons. Assistance and training goes on. And so in that respect, although Ukraine is fighting by itself, and I think we have to be quite explicit about that, against a much larger and more powerful neighbor, it does have a lot of support militarily coming from the outside, which has helped it to fight Russia to more or less a standstill 7 weeks into the war, which I think is not what was expected by most military analysts at the beginning. So I think I should stop there, and I'm happy to take any questions that people might have about any aspect of this war or Russian or Ukrainian politics.
Thank you, Professor Taylor. One question here. Years of sanctions against Iran, North Korea, and Cuba have affected little change in external behavior that matters to the U.S. and its allies. Why is it reasonable to think results will be otherwise with Russia?
That's a great question. I think I already alluded to my belief that the sanctions are not in any way going to stop the war anytime soon, that the war will continue, that it is impossible to use sanctioning power to stop the Russian invasion into Ukraine. The only thing that will stop that is if they are militarily defeated on the battlefield. On the other hand, you know, as I already mentioned, this is the largest set of sanctions ever put on an economy of Russia's size. And Russia clearly has considerable resources that can keep their economy going. They still continue to sell oil and gas in global markets. And the increased price of oil and gas is actually bringing more revenue into the Russian economy. So I think the big debate, you've probably been noticing this, is what's going to happen in Europe in terms of imports of Russian oil and gas. They made a decision last week to cut back on imports of Russian coal because it's fairly easy to replace the coal that they got from Russia. It's harder to replace Russian oil, and it's extremely hard for Europe in a short term to replace Russian gas. And so they've been hesitant to go that route, but there is growing support as more evidence of Russian war crimes comes out for trying to either cut back or even stop the import of Russian oil. Now, if Europe is going to do this, this is a good time because we're coming into spring. And so they're less dependent upon Russian oil and energy for, you know, keeping people warm in winter and that kind of thing. And things, I think, can be done to try and encourage other major oil producing states, not only the U.S. and Canada, but Saudi Arabia and other Gulf countries to produce more oil and in some sense try and replace Russian oil. But this is a longer term prospect. And I think the questioner is right that we shouldn't expect the sanctions to either lead to Putin's overthrow anytime soon or to lead to Russia deciding to stop the war. What the sanctions are doing are crippling any ability of Russia to grow its economy going forward. I think they're in for long-term recession, if not depression. Lots of Western companies decided on their own to pull out of the Russian market. I don't see many of those going back into the Russian market as this war is going on. And I don't really see much important external investment in Russia, at least from the West, as long as Vladimir Putin is in power. So everyone understood the Russian economy that they were, even prior to the war, in a state of stagnation. They'd grown on average about 1% a year over the last 9 years. That's not going to change. And in fact, it's going to get worse because they don't have the investment that they need to raise productivity, to produce more, and to raise the living standards of their population. So Russian living standards are going down. The Russian economy will remain in recession. Unemployment will go up. Inflation will go up. But you're right, that's not going to bring the regime down, and it's not going to stop the war.
Thank you, Professor. Let's see. Is there anything the international community can do to limit escalations beyond sanctions?
Yeah, limiting escalation. I mean, I think the main thing that the US and NATO are trying to do to limit escalation is to not get directly involved in the war. So you probably recall there's been a big debate. It's kind of died down a bit in the last few weeks, but there was a big debate about whether the United States and NATO should try and impose a so-called no-fly zone over all or part of Ukrainian territory. And the U.S. government and our NATO allies decided it was not willing to do that because what it would mean to try and impose a no-fly zone over territory as big as Ukraine, which I'll remind you is roughly the size of Texas. So we're talking about a considerable territory to try and keep all planes out of the air, right? That's what a no-fly zone means. It would mean the willingness to shoot down Russian airplanes. It would probably mean a willingness to attack Russian air defense systems located in Russia. And this would mean a direct military conflict between NATO and Russia, which would mean the possibility of escalation with Russian attacks on NATO member states. That has not happened. I think it was a mistake for people to recommend a no-fly zone. I think it was too risky, and it would lead to a chance of escalation to war between the United States and NATO and Russia, which I think most people are hoping to avoid. So that's been the most important thing to do to prevent escalation. What I will say is I think some of us are worried that as the war continues to go badly for Russia, if it does continue to go badly, they may try and escalate by extending attacks on other areas or using chemical weapons or something like that, and putting in us in a situation in which countries outside of Ukraine feel the need to intervene directly. I don't think the U.S. will do that, but it's a very kind of risky situation we're in, because I don't expect Vladimir Putin to just sort of admit, oh, I made a mistake, I'm going to pull out, the war is over. I think he will continue to seek ways to keep the war going and potentially lash out at targets. Even in the last 24 hours, we saw the flagship ship of the Black Sea Fleet in the Russian Black Sea Fleet. The Moskva cruiser was hit by a missile by Ukrainians and apparently is sunk, although this remains to be confirmed. So as more and more embarrassing episodes like that occur, I expect Russia to further escalate. Unfortunately, I think what that means is more devastating attack on civilians in Ukraine. It's very sad to say that, but that seems to be the course the war has been running so far. When Russia can't achieve its objectives in any other way, it launches larger assaults on civilian populations.
Thank you. How much assistance do you anticipate from China? And what do you think the impact of their role will be?
Yeah, excellent question. So China and Russia are not allies, but they're very close. They call themselves strategic partners. Xi Jinping and Putin have met more face-to-face than any other leader for the two of them over the last 10 years. And it's clear that they have a relatively similar view of international politics. They both don't like the fact that the U.S. is the dominant global power. They want to change that system. They don't like the fact that the U.S. and its allies promote the spread of democracy and human rights in the world. They would prefer the countries not talk about human rights abuses in Russia and in China. And China wants to keep a good relationship with Russia, both because they want a stable border to the north so they can concentrate on what they see as more important security threats to the southeast in the Asian Pacific region, having to do with the United States, with South Korea and Japan, for example. Russia's an important source of oil and gas for China. Historically, most Russian oil and gas actually has gone to the west, not to the east. That has been slowly changing over the last 15 years and probably will continue to change. So Russia remains close to China, and China supports them in votes in the Security Council often and things like that. Now, having said that, it seems pretty clear from some things that China has done that it is worried about the effect of possible secondary sanctions on getting too close to Russia. They're worried that their own companies will be hit with sanctions if they continue to trade with Russia in certain ways. So we saw just the last week that the Chinese cell phone company Huawei has limited its presence in Russia. And so they will continue to support Russia politically and in some sense economically. But they also, I think, they meaning the Chinese, will try and get better deals in terms of the purchases of Russian oil and gas going forward. So in that sense, they'll exploit Russia's current weakness to advantage themselves going forward. But the questioner is right that this is kind of a hole in the sanctions regime when the second largest economy in the world continues to trade with Russia. But I do think it will limit Chinese investment in Russia, in the Russian economy going forward because of this fear of falling under some kind of sanctions that would hurt Chinese economic development. So China is willing to help Russia, but they're not willing to hurt themselves while doing so, which puts some limits on the extent of cooperation.
Thank you. Do you think it was wise for Biden to announce that the U.S. would not employ troops?
Yeah, I do actually, because I don't think there was any feasible scenario in which the U.S. would want to engage directly in a war with the other nuclear superpower. I mean, we spent the 45 years of the Cold War doing everything possible to avoid getting in a direct shooting war with the Soviet Union, from the Cuban Missile Crisis, to the war in Afghanistan, to other military conflicts. It was always understood that the risk of escalation to nuclear war meant we should avoid situations in which Russian and American forces, then Soviet and American forces, now Russian and American forces, are shooting directly at one another, because the risk of escalation to nuclear war is simply too great. So I think it was reasonable to be very explicit with Ukrainians and with the Russians that the U.S. is not fighting this war, and with the American people, quite frankly, that we're not putting our military forces into Ukraine to fight directly in a war with Russia. Now, I think some people think that weakened our deterrence, but I think the Russians already understood that we were not planning on fighting directly on the Ukrainian side, and that our engagement with Ukraine would be political, economic, and military assistance, but not the direct deployment of troops. Now, I will say that one of the reasons that the Ukrainian military has seemingly fought as well as it has is more than a decade of training and engagement with the U.S. military. And Ukraine, unlike Russia, has managed to adapt some elements of Western military organization, especially the use of what are called non-commissioned officers, what we think of as sergeants, who play this intermediate role between the officer corps and enlisted personnel. Ukraine became very good at using sergeants effectively. Russia has never been able to do that. And I think that reflects at least some of the success Ukraine has achieved militarily. So U.S. support is important, but I think it also was important to say we're not going to war directly with the other nuclear superpower in this conflict.
Thank you. What does the end of the war look like? Can you speak to 5 years from now and some of the potential impacts?
Yeah. What does the end of the war look like? I wish I knew. A general rule for people who study international relations is that most wars end in some kind of settlement. They don't end with a complete defeat of one side by the other. And I don't think we can imagine any scenario at all in which Ukraine advances an attack on Russia. That's not going to happen, right? So that means that it's going to have to make some kind of deal with Russia that ends the war at some point. I mean, the other alternative, obviously, is a complete Russian victory over Ukraine. And I don't think we see that happening at this point either. So even if Russia at some point decides it's exhausted itself and has advanced as far as it can, unless they make some settlement with Russia, Ukrainians will continue to fight against Russians that are, occupying part of their territory. So some low-level insurgency would continue even if a Russian assault, was stopped. So in that sense, I think it's probably likely to drag on for a while. We may see some sort of ceasefire in which the sort of territorial gains that have been made so far by Russia are rolled back partially, but not entirely. Russia has given itself an out by recognizing early on, at the very start of the war, these two regions in southeast Ukraine known as the Donbass and Donetsk and Luhansk. So they might be able to sell to their own population, they meaning Putin and the Russian government, that they've achieved their objectives. They've quote unquote liberated the Donbass, and they degraded the Ukrainian military and prevented Ukraine from joining NATO, which it wasn't going to do anyway, and therefore declare victory and go home. Now, whether Ukraine will be willing to give up any of that territory after the deaths of thousands, after the war crimes that they've seen, I'm not sure. I mean, Zelensky has a great deal of credibility with his own population and with the global population. So he could probably come to some sort of settlement if he thought it was in Ukraine's best interest, and Ukrainians would probably accept that, but it would be a bitter pill to swallow. So the question goes out 5 years. I don't see any real end to the confrontation between Russia and Ukraine, even if the war stops for some period of time, or between Russia and the West, till Vladimir Putin is not in power, honestly. As long as he's in power in Russia, the chance of further war in Ukraine will persist, even if there is a settlement, you know, in the coming months and years that stops the active fighting, because I don't think he's going to give up on his objective to, you know, pull Ukraine into the Russian sphere of influence. Now, let me say a few things about Putin. He's 69 years old. Average life expectancy for a Russian man is 72. He obviously gets the best healthcare available in Russia, so we shouldn't compare him to the average Russian man. There are recent rumors and reports by investigative journalists in Russia that he has back trouble, and he's had it for some time, and that even he may have had a bout with thyroid cancer. They tracked the flights of a big team of thyroid surgeons and experts to one of his palaces in southern Russia over the last, you know, 3-4 years. So we don't know for sure what his health situation is, but the guy is not going to live forever. So he could fall from power that way. He could eventually fall from power because of some internal opposition. But if that happens, I think it's years in the future and not in the coming months. So unfortunately, for the foreseeable future, there's some kind of conflict going on, whether it's active or passive, as long as he's in power.
Does he have a designated predecessor in his mind if something were to happen to him?
Yeah, that's a great question. In fact, I'm writing an article about this that I hope will be out in about a week. So we don't know the answer to that question. We have suspicions and guesses about who might be the expected successor. Now, if he were to suddenly drop dead tomorrow, the way the Constitution is set up is that the prime minister becomes acting president. They're supposed to call new elections in 3 months, and then there would be an election to elector, come with quotation marks, right? They're elections that they know the winner in advance. So the presumption would be that if this happened, that the current prime minister, a guy named Mikhail Mishustin, who's got more of an economic and technical background than a military background or security police background, would probably have the upper hand in any sort of fight inside the regime about who's going to succeed Putin, because he would immediately be acting president, would move into the Kremlin, would command the resources of the Kremlin administration, control over television and all those sorts of things. Now, there are other people in the elite who probably also believe that they should be the successor and should be president. And there would be behind the scenes a fierce struggle over that. British Prime Minister Winston Churchill, during the Stalin period, compared politics in the Soviet Union to bulldogs fighting under a carpet. And we only know who's won when we see which bones are thrown out from underneath the carpet. And I think that would kind of be the situation here. There would be an intense power struggle. And eventually someone would come out on top, because historically in Russia, with really a brief exception from the late 1980s until the early 2000s, the elite tends to choose their own ruler. They don't leave it up to the people because they don't trust the people to make the right decision. So there will be some internal battles about this, but I think it's, let me say one final thing about this. I think it's fair to say that people don't believe that Mishustin is who Putin would choose as his successor if he had the choice. In fact, it's believed that he was given this role to put off a decision about a successor, and that he had a more limited role to try and get the economy going, to try and make some technical improvements in government efficiency and that kind of thing. That was his sort of mandate as prime minister, and that's what he's been working on. And Putin doesn't want to put someone who's his designated successor as prime minister, because it immediately makes that person more of a threat to him. So whoever he sees as his potential successor, if he sees anyone in that role, he's not going to tip his hand. And let me say one final thing about this. In 2000, Putin amended the Constitution to quote unquote nullify his previous service as president so he can legally run, according to the current Russian constitution, for re-election in 2024 and in 2030 and serve as president until 2036, at which point he would be over 80 years old. So I think most people think at this point, Putin sees himself as president for life, and we just don't know what that lifespan is. So there is a procedure constitutionally in place. That's actually how Putin became president, right? Boris Yeltsin resigned. Putin was prime minister. He became acting president, ran for election 3 months later in 2000, and that was the start of his political career. So it could happen to this prime minister, Mishustin, but it would be a surprise event, obviously, if that were to happen.
Thank you. What do you think about Putin's nuclear war threats?
Yeah, I was afraid someone was going to ask about that because I don't like talking about nuclear war on a Thursday morning or any other time of day or time of the week. So part of it is clearly an element of saber rattling, right? One area in which Russia is one of the two main powers in the world is number of nuclear weapons. It's the U.S., and Russia and everyone else, China, Britain, France, you know, Israel, et cetera, have a lot fewer nuclear weapons. It's US and Russia that have thousands between them. And it's why arms control has always been, you know, primarily a Russia-US thing. And one of the things that Putin did during his military rearmament campaign over the last decade was put even more money into nuclear weapons. In some sense, one can see that as a mistake, right? Because they should have been putting more into their ground forces and less into nuclear weapons. But they have, you know, these new nuclear weapons that they've been developing. He likes to talk about how they have weapons that no one else has. But it's still the fact that they're not really that usable in any militarily meaningful way. They could not be used other than to cause massive civilian loss of life. And so he can threaten to use them, but it's not rational to use them in any way to try and affect the course of the war in Ukraine. Now, not to bum everyone out too much, but it also was not rational to go to war with Ukraine, but he did. So I would not rule anything out. I think, you know, we are in a situation in which the risk, unfortunately, of them trying some kind of nuclear demonstration, you know, is shooting off one in, you know, over Ukrainian territory, to a small one to try and send a signal, is not 100% out of the question. I know that's terrifying because nuclear weapons have not been used since 1945, and there is kind of a taboo against their use. So I don't think it's going to happen ultimately, but I think it would be naive to say the risk hasn't increased because Putin has put himself in a position where he sees Russia as being existentially threatened through his own actions. And that's the only condition under Russian nuclear doctrine in which they're supposed to be able to use nuclear weapons, is when there's an existential threat to the state. Now, there isn't an existential threat to the state, but I think Putin might see losing this war as at least a threat to his regime. And in that sense, I'm worried about the possibility of further escalation. I don't think we're going to get there, but I'm much more worried about this than I was 7 weeks ago, unfortunately.
There are so many comments that thank you for taking such a complex situation and making it more understandable, and gratitude for your work and area of expertise. I'd like to thank you, Professor Taylor, today for being our guest speaker. I'd like to thank the audience for attending today and sharing their valuable time with us. I'm going to ask people to join us next Thursday when we hear from Syracuse Mayor Ben Walsh. Our presentations are recorded and available for viewing at the Office of Community Engagement video channel page. The forums are recorded through a partnership with WCNY Radio, and the audio versions can be found on WCNY Thursday Morning Roundtable webpage. Thank you again so much, Professor Taylor. Thank you again for sharing your time. Audience, thank you so much for your presence and attendance. Thank you.